Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is August the 26th, 1999. And in Koinonia Fireside Room this evening is Leroy Eisaminger. His session is called The Invisible Prison Inmate Wait, number 99-4. Let's listen in.
And I am pastor of a very unique congregation in South Dakota. It's called St. Dismas. Dismas is believed to be the name of the thief who died alongside of Jesus asking to be remembered. And when it came time for the men of our congregation to name their congregation that was developed, they said, let's call it Dismas, D-Y-S-M-A-S, in the hopes that the body of Christ, you folks, would again hear the prayer of the thief and remember those who are in prison. And I've put up on the blackboard a Bible verse, and if I offend anyone, by the way, I have used a couple of the words, I hope that you'll forgive me, but James 1:27 says, a religion that is pure and undefiled before God the Father is this, to care for orphans. And here I'm putting children without fathers or mothers. And I'm thinking especially of those children whose parent or both parents are in prison. And widows, wives without husbands, wives whose husbands are in prison in their distress. Religion that is pure and undefiled before God the Father is this, to care for the orphans and widows in their distress. And I want you to be aware that for every person that you go and visit in the hospital, there are five persons behind bars in this country. I lived in South Dakota for most of my life, and our penitentiary is situated on the road on the street that leads to the stockyards in Sioux Falls. And as a boy, I would accompany my father in our farm truck as he hauled livestock to the market. And we would go past that penitentiary. I would see the trustees out mowing the lawn or something. Later on, when I became pastor in a congregation near Sioux Falls, I would have to go past this penitentiary on the way to make hospital calls in one of the hospitals. And I would see the trustees. Every once in a while, I would have a parishioner become an inmate, and I would go to the visit room. But not once, did I ever consider that behind every one of these inmates, there was somebody who loved them, a family member. Until I became a pastor within the congregation. And at our first worship service, we had open prayer. We called them popcorn prayers, where they would just give a short sentence prayer. And one of the men said, I pray for my family, who's doing 35 years along with me. I could barely conduct the rest of the service. Where in the world have I been? Of course, behind each of these prison inmates, there was a family member that I had overlooked and not even considered. And as a pastor, I have become aware that these people are the unseen inmates. People don't see them. And part of that is due to the shame that society attaches to the family. And so early in my ministry, I developed a support group called WAIT, W-A-I-T, which stands for We Are Inmates Too. And I'd appreciate it if one of you ladies here would take and pass out those. We developed a 10-week course for these people, a support group. At first, we met once a week. And then we began to meet every other week. And finally, we decided on a schedule the first and third Tuesdays of every month that we would get together with adult family members and provide support for these people going through this experience of having a loved one in prison. Shortly, about 6 years into the program, we became aware that we're really not doing anything for the children of these families. And so we have now developed a children's program. But let me read you something that I have taken out of the Minneapolis Star Tribune. Dear Abby, my husband is in prison. When old friends and acquaintances ask me how he's doing, it tells me they still care and acknowledge him as a person. When a man goes to prison, much is stripped away from him, along with his street clothes, his dignity, his pride, his possessions, and all too often, his family. When an old friend or acquaintance acknowledges my husband, it's like giving him back a bit of himself. He appreciates being told that someone asked about him. What bothers me more than anything are those who whisper behind my back, won't look me in the eye, and act uncomfortable around me, as if they would like to ask but don't know how. It would be much more polite just to ask. Could I ask here, how many of you know someone who has a loved one in prison? Any of you? Some of you do. Yeah, okay. Well, what's it like to have a loved one in prison? And I've distributed among some of you here tonight a letter that I would like to have you read. I'd like to have you read Wilma's letter that I gave you to the group. And you're going to be Wilma. And the other ladies, you'll be the person on your letter. So Wilma, can we hear from you what it's like to have your husband being sentenced to prison? Yes.
Dear Leroy, I am writing this letter to share with you the many feelings, fear, frustration, anger, loneliness, etc., and the reality of surviving the prison sentence of a loved one. In my case, my husband, I used to believe in truth, justice, and a fair system of dealing with crime and punishment. However, after experiencing firsthand the system, I find myself disillusioned and bitter from the inequities and sheer randomness with which many people are treated by court officials and prison personnel. I am fortunate to be educated and employed in a good job that provides economic freedom that many others do not enjoy. I can only imagine what it would be like to suddenly survive on one income when two barely got you by. Beyond the economics, there is the constant frustration of trying to get information on what you can and cannot do. The inmate is given an orientation as part of the process into prison life, but no one orients the family or provides information on what to expect, what can be sent in the mail, or what kind of rules there are for the family. And there are plenty of rules. Although inmates lose their freedom, families lose stability and continuity in their life. Life goes on for the families, holidays, birthdays, anniversaries, carnivals, school activities, etc. The loneliness and frustration can be deafening. All the emotions of daily life are accentuated by the absence of your loved one. But unlike death, there isn't finality. There's only hope that one day in the future, you'll be able to put the pieces of your life back together. You can't get back all the lost events of the past, but you hope for solace in the prison system guidelines and the Board of Pardons and Paroles. But even there is no comfort. There is old law and new law guidelines. No one, not even the warden, can say for certain when your loved one may be released. The administration of the law and the application of the guidelines is arbitrary and subject to human interpretation and philosophy. All these dealings with this system create a perpetual frustration and sense of hopelessness. The system is so focused on punishment of the inmate that the families are all but forgotten, even though 48% fewer inmates reoffend when they have family involved in their life during incarceration. With family involvement, almost half as many inmates reoffend. So why aren't the prisons paying attention to them? My husband has been in prison for almost a year. He was supposed to be released this week, but he wasn't. Now we wait for a hearing before the Board of Pardons and Paroles at the end of August. His sons remember that Dad was supposed to come home in August. I haven't had the heart or the courage to explain that he is not coming home yet. I also can't tell them when he might come home. So the uncertainty continues along with the frustration. I continue to ask questions and continue to get varied answers. I am glad that there are people like you, Pastor Isaminger, who can provide solace through prayerful support of the families. Without my faith and belief in God, I don't think I would have the patience and the courage to continue. My husband has struggled mentally, physically, and spiritually. I have had to find the strength to encourage him in face of my own doubts and despairs. Having a loved one in prison is the most challenging situation that anyone could face. I only hope that God continues to provide me with the courage and patience to survive. Wilma Ellie.
Okay, thanks, Wilma. Now the rest of you, when you heard Wilma, what did you hear? What did you hear? What was her experience? What was she experiencing? What was she feeling?
Loneliness.
Loneliness.
Great frustration.
Frustration.
Anger.
Anger. Yeah. Okay.
Self-doubt.
Self-doubt. Is that what you said? Yeah. Mm-hmm. I'm hard of hearing, so you might have to speak up. Okay. Can Marlene read hers? Marlene? Okay, yeah, you're Marlene.
I am?
Yeah.
Oh, there's no names.
Oh.
This might be hard for me because my son has been in jail a lot. Unless having experienced the trauma, no one knows what it's like to have a loved one in prison. It is something you will never forget. This person is living with you, and within minutes, he's gone. It's almost like a death. Except, you know, someday he'll be back with you again.
Yeah. Okay.
Your life begins a whole new role. You need to make decisions and get a second job, enable to exist as the main breadwinner. The main breadwinner is gone. In my case, it was to have an auction, move, and then 6 months later, move to another location to be able to visit without driving so many miles, find new jobs, and reestablish again. Your loved one will also be moved to different facilities, some miles from where you have relocated to be able to visit, so you are still traveling. Also, each facility has different rules and they need different things, so you need to send him things or he needs to send things home. As the loved one of a prisoner, you are also looked down on by some friends and relatives, even though you had nothing to do with the situation. You feel ashamed, rejected, disappointed, and humiliated. You feel lonely and sometimes wonder if you want to go on, if it's worth it. Then you think of the loved one behind those walls, and you know he is suffering those things also. And you need to be there for him. So you go on and face it together. You think about all the crimes being committed every day, but just some unlucky ones pay the price. If it hadn't been for our faith in God, the support of the church, and the WAIT support group led by Pastor Eisminger, it would have been difficult to go on. Also, friends and relatives who were forgiving and understanding were very supportive.
What did you hear Marlene say?
She got the luck of the draw.
You become the breadwinner. All of a sudden, everything is on your shoulders. How do you cope? Your loved one is gone. Disruption of your home. Having to have an auction. Moving. Yeah. You have Rachel. Here, is that?
I have Kathy.
Pardon?
I have Kathy.
Kathy, I meant Kathy.
Kathy.
I meant Kathy, yes.
My husband went to prison on August 8, 1991, and was released on parole on December 8, 1994. That adds up to 40 months, 1,218 days and nights I had to live without him. Within only 28 days of his incarceration, he was transferred to a county jail facility 350 miles away. I was able to visit him only twice in 10 months, and that was for only 30 minutes through the glass talking on the telephone. It was and still is the most traumatic time in my life. It was an absolute shock at the time, and some days I still feel like I'm still in shock. I just can't believe that something this terrible could have happened to me, to us. My husband is a criminal, a convict. This sort of thing happens to other people, not us, and I just read about it in the newspaper. The kids to this day can't believe that Dad would do this to them, literally pull the carpet out from under them, abandon Mom and them to survive on their own. Many days they would come home from work or school and cry about it, feeling so helpless, so out of control. I don't need to tell you how cruel some other kids can be. There were harassing phone calls at first. Every time the phone would ring, I just wanted to run into the bedroom and hide under the bed. This was not my fault. Why do people want to torture me? Eventually, I had to change the phone number and get an unlisted number just to get some relief from the harassment. People can really be mean. It was really a struggle to simply survive. My whole life was turned upside down. I had to work two jobs to make ends meet and pay all the bills. The whole household was suddenly my sole responsibility, and I didn't know how to handle it all. It was the mortgage, car payments, insurances, gas bill. It went on and on. Besides that, I had to mow the damn lawn, and I hated it. I needed help. There was no way I could deal with all this by myself. I wanted to turn to God. He was always there when I needed him before. But I was very mad at him. Where was he now? How could he do this to me? I don't deserve all this. After a while, I realized I was not doing this alone. God was in my life more now than ever. He was no longer by my side holding my hand, but rather he had gathered me up into his arms and was carrying me through this. My children and family were my lifesavers. They held me up. I had to depend on their love and support more than ever before in my life. There were frequent calls, cards, and unexpected visits. This is how I was able to deal with my life as a prison widow. Days went by, weeks led to months, and the time seemed to slip away. I heard about a group in town called WAIT, W-A-I-T. We are inmates too. A group of people who have loved ones in prison. I went to a meeting and soon realized I was not the only one in the world caught in this ugly situation. We talked together, cried together, hugged a lot, and held each other up as best we could. It was exactly what I needed, when I needed it, and I found it there. Now my husband is out of prison and home again. We try to live a normal life, but it will never be the same as it was. I thank God every day for helping me survive. I am thankful to my children, my family, and the Wade group. But you know, I still hate mowing the lawn. Kathy.
What did you hear? What feelings?
She's also concerned about how the children were affected. And towards the very end, even though the family was reconciled again, that trust bonding didn't exist.
Right. Yeah. This letter is from Bernice, and her husband was arrested. He was drunk when he was arrested, and he was arrested because he assaulted two young girls. And she talks about the betrayal of the wedding vows. How in the world could this have happened? Those kinds of feelings. You're Pam. Would you?
Yes.
Yeah.
I remember being numb. Numb with shock and grief when the judge pronounced the sentence. 10 years. 10 years in prison for my husband. What would happen to him, to us? How could we go on? How could we survive this? Was this the end of our marriage? It was an end to life as we knew it. What a mess our lives had become. It was hard to come home after the hearing to an empty house and to think of my husband of 13 years being behind the walls with no one to comfort him. I remember the police officer handing me his belongings, his wallet, keys, identification, everything that he had in his possession except for his wedding ring and the Bible that my brother-in-law pressed firmly into the hands of the guard who was leading him away. We were allowed a brief few minutes to say goodbye, hands touching, hands through glass, tears streaming down our faces, the pain, the loss. It was all so unbearable. 10 years, to us it seemed like a lifetime. The journey for me along the way was hard, one day at a time, counting the days, months, years. I too had been sentenced to 10 years. How would I pay the bills that took two salaries to manage? Would I be able to keep the house? Who would be there to do the chores my husband took care of? The snow shoveling, mowing the grass, fixing the car, household repairs. I took a second job working at cleaning office buildings in the evening. I managed. I was filled with shame. Who would be my friend? Who would stand beside me, beside my husband? How could I hold up my head? My husband was in prison. It was hard to tell anyone what had happened to us. Who would even care? Even sitting in church, I felt alone, felt that I too was condemned. Would people accept me if they knew? Would I be shunned? I remember how hard it was to visit my husband in prison, but it soon became a routine of 2 to 3 visits a week, a few letters, and a phone call once a week. The visit room was cramped. No touching was allowed except for a brief hug and kiss at the beginning and the end of a visit. I remember that the long waits to get in for a visit and how quickly they passed. I felt the impersonal way the families were treated by the guards for the most part were not allowed to be overly friendly towards us, the inmate's family. And the rules that often didn't make sense and that were changed frequently. We had no way to make a personal call to our inmate if something came up at home. You just had to wait until the next visit or had to write a letter or wait for that weekly call home. The 10 years turned out to be 6.5 years. He has been home now for 1 year and 8 months. I remember being excited and scared when it was time for him to come home. It had been a long time of making decisions on my own. Would we get along? Would he find a job? Looking back now over those trying years, I see much evidence of how God provided for us along the way. Through God's grace and mercy, we made it through these tough years. Many helping, caring, loving people have been there for us. The Saint Dismas,
Saint Dismas.
Ministry people from the churches who came to the prison for church services, the WAIT support group, our church, our parents, our families, especially my sister Becky and her husband Tom. Most of all, we give thanks to God who stood beside us. He is our comforter, our provider, our deliverer, and our friend.
Well, Pam, how did you feel when you found out that your husband was sentenced to 10 years?
Numb with shock. Yeah. And grief that came through.
Can it happen to anyone? Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's the troubling thing about all of this. It can happen to anyone. I'll read just a couple paragraphs. One evening a few years ago, Jerry Nail slid unobtrusively into the back row of her church. "Lord, I just can't do it anymore. I've even crawled as far as I can go. This time, Lord, I'm down and I can't get up." Jerry was normally the picture of confidence and vitality. She had earned national acclaim for her training seminars in communication. As one friend described her, Jerry had never faced a mountain she couldn't climb, but this new mountain had sapped all of her energy. Her beloved and bright son, Matthew, who in 29 years had brought nothing but great pride to their family, had now brought distress and destruction. Declared mentally ill and guilty of several violent crimes, he now faced life in prison with no possibility of parole. It also hurt that people in her church avoided the issue. She said, "I think they just didn't know how to respond to me. I was dying to tell somebody what I was going through every day, but people were so afraid to talk to me. If just a few of them had said, 'We're going to be there for you,' or had even done something small like bringing the rest of our family a casserole, it would have helped so very much." The unseen inmate. Society puts the real inmate behind walls so we can't see them. But so very often we cannot see members of their family. Orpha, I'll have you read some selective passages there from Janine's letter.
"What's it like to have a son in prison? My first thought when Pastor Ike made his request was, it's hell on earth. But there are varying degrees of hell on earth. Beginning at age 14 and our son's first drink at a cousin's wedding, purchased by older cousins, thinking God only knows what, our son with so much potential and so many dreams took off on a self-destruct course that in itself was hell on earth for the entire family and especially for him. And this did not end until he was 23 years of age. By age 17, it was evident to all concerned that our son was an alcoholic. These years were very difficult, and at 17, he was in his first inpatient drug alcohol program, again the following year. Then followed several outpatient programs, trouble with the law, car accidents, every imaginable type of craziness you can imagine, jail time, prison time, all alcohol drug related, though alcohol was primarily his drug of choice. On a 4th of July long weekend, after a 4-day binge of drinking and drugs, he committed a felony for which he was sentenced to the state penitentiary on 3 counts. One for 10 years, second count 10 years, third 50 years, to be conserved consecutively. His first possible parole was in 2004. He has now been in prison 9 years. So what's it like to have a son in prison? Your entire world crashes down. You're ostracized in your community church neighborhood. The news media reports the events statewide. Local and statewide newspapers also carry the news. Your name is trashed. There's no place to hide. From then on, his name is never mentioned except for a few choice friends and some extended family. You go through the motions of living. You seek professional help for him and your entire family. You continue working through your, though your name badge now only shows your first name. You are uncertain about your son, not knowing if he had a complete psychotic break. Your heart is broken and shattered and in so much pain, you feel like you could die and sometimes pray for that. You also think it would have been better for your child to have died. Life will never again be the same. You are thrown into a world of police, sheriff, attorneys, judges, bail, criminal justice system, Department of Corrections. You are definitely in unknown territory. You soon learn a new language. You flounder. You make mistakes. You experience rage to a degree you never thought possible. You weep till there are no more tears. You are physically, mentally, and emotionally drained. You exist in a void. The stars no longer shine. The lights have gone out. You are obsessed with your problems, and no one on this earth has ever experienced what you are going through. Slowly, haltingly, miraculously, each day your prayers are answered by a note from a friend or a coworker, a card of inspiration, a phone call from family and a few rare friends, your sis arriving, though 500 miles away, within hours of your first call to family. You scream at God for answers. You ask unanswerable questions. You rapidly learn there's no cookbook to lead you through this mess. You draw on every resource and reserve that is at your disposal. You become totally disillusioned with court-appointed attorneys. How do you raise bail of $250,000? Do you dare, even if you could? How stable is your son? Would you and the rest of your family be safe? So many questions and no answers. For 5 months, our son sits in our local county jail. A sheriff we once considered a good guy now becomes a hated, mistrusted enemy. Our court-appointed attorney continually tries to convince you and convince us that our son is a lost cause. The only solution is to lock him up and throw away the key. Dear God, how can anyone know our son based on one incident when we have known and loved and watched him develop into a very sensitive, compassionate, caring young man for over 20 years, knowing very well there are problems. Yes, life has been hell on wheels these past nearly 10 years with all kinds of crazy making events and experiences. But deep in his core, Lord, he is your very special child and mine. He didn't grow under my heart, but in it. And dear God, I do not have a throwaway child anymore than you who left the flock to find one sheep. I will never abandon him.
So what did you hear from Janine?
A lot of pain.
A lot of pain. And, you know, there's, with the amount of people who are in prisons all over our country, in every state, the governor of the state of Washington recently punned, I think, that if the present trend continues, that by the year 2020, half the people in Washington will be in prison and the other half will be taking care of them. He's saying something else has to be done. We just can't keep building prisons and locking people up, because behind every person who is locked up, there's a family. And in South Dakota, I think it's very conservative to say that it costs $20,000 a year to keep a man behind bars. But if that man is the breadwinner, then his wife or the mother of his children goes on state welfare to the tune of $15,000. So you have $35,000 there to take care of this issue of a man writing a $17 bad check. is thrown into prison for that. You know, some of these things just don't make sense, but that's the way our country is operating. The video that I hope I know how to run, I should bring my granddaughter here, little granddaughter, she knows how to run this thing, gives you some entry into the dynamics that go on within a family who has this problem.
Are you finished? Richard, it's me, Liz. Look, I just got back. How'd it go? How long till he's out, Sophie?
10 years. He got 10 years.
Good God, I thought the lawyer said 6 months if he bargained. What are you going to do?
Wait, I guess. Wait.
Well, isn't there something you can do? Appeal or parole or something?
You can't appeal it, Liz. He pleaded guilty.
Well, where is he now?
I don't know. I haven't heard.
When was the hearing?
What day is this?
Thursday.
Thursday. No, I mean, what's the date?
The 11th.
3 days ago, May 8th.
3 days? And you haven't heard? Well, is he in prison or
what? I don't know where he is. The last time I saw him was in court, and the judge said 10 years, and they put the handcuffs back on him, and they took him out the side door. That's the last I saw him. That's all I know.
So, how are you, Sophie?
Tired, I guess. I don't know.
I'm sorry. I shouldn't have called so late.
How was your vacation?
Look, you get to bed. I'll stop by tomorrow. Leave the kids with the... Oh, no. Saturday, I can't.
If it gets any better, I'll call.
Sophie, are you okay?
No, Liz. I'm definitely not. Look, Liz, just hang up, okay?
Sure, Sophie. Good night.
Anne, you haven't washed your face. There's still sleep in your eyes. Yes, you have to. Go now. Joshua, use up the old box of cereal first. It'll get stale if you don't. Are you ready? Did Betty say she'd take you swimming? Joshua, there's no time to call now. I have to get to work. If I'm late, I might get fired. I told you that. I explained it all to you. How will we eat and keep this house warm if I get fired? Hurry up and get ready. Don't you yell at me, Joshua Williams. Why do you do this? If your father were here, you know he'd... I put him in prison. Who told you that? Get out of here! Get your dirty mouth out of here! Hello? Sick? But I just put her on the bus not 20 minutes ago. She was fine then, are you sure? Oh, well, no, I can't. I don't have transportation. The car is broken. Is there a teacher who could bring her home? Oh, no, wait, I have to work today. I have to try and find a sitter. Could I call you back in 10 minutes? Yes, thank you. What's the matter, Josh? Oh, nothing, huh? Oh, I saw you when you came in from school today. You'd been crying. What did he say? Oh, Joshua, you know that's not true. Your father made a mistake, that's all. A lot of people make mistakes, and some of them land in prison, and some of them don't. Yes, what he did was a crime, but that doesn't give Tommy the right to...
How does he know, anyway? Are you sure? I didn't see it in the paper. I don't know, Joshua. I don't know why he did it. Look, have you brushed your teeth yet? Why don't you go upstairs and brush your teeth, and then you can stay up and read for a while, okay?
Getting through, right? So, how are you doing, Sophie?
I do okay. The generator on the car broke down, and I stuck the check to the water company and the envelope to the telephone company, and before I could get it straightened out, they turned it off.
The phone?
No, the water. I was so mad. Geez, I was mad.
You don't sound too good.
Well, thanks. Thanks a lot. Are you okay?
Yeah, I'm all right.
They don't beat you up or...
No, I'm fine. So, did you get the car fixed?
Yeah, but I probably got soaked for it. I took it to that place you used to go, but the regular man wasn't there. It was just this young kid, and I had to have it. 2 days before that, Annie had a temperature in school, and there was no way I could get her. I was riding with Wilma, and Josh and I got it junked from Wilma's car, but anyway, they said I need a new one.
Can you keep up with the bills?
What is this? You sound like my mother.
Well, it's just that I feel helpless.
You should see Annie. She acts like she's been going to school for 10 years. You remember how Joshua couldn't sleep the night before school, before the first day?
Yes.
Annie could care less. Oh, she lost her third tooth. She can't even eat anymore now. I kept around the corners of her mouth.
Look, this phone call's getting expensive. We can write it right out.
Richard, listen,
I'll give you an address.
Yet. I'll be able
write
to...
Write me a letter, okay?
Wait!
My address is Stylecone Federal Penitentiary.
No, I don't have a pencil.
Ready?
No. Yes.
Stylecone Federal Penitentiary, Box 801, Stylecone, Washington, 30898. Did you get it?
30 what?
30898.
Why, I hate letters. I can't write.
All right, I'll call again. Whenever they let me, all right? I love you, Sophie.
Richard, wait, don't hang up yet.
Look, I'll call again, I promise. When the kids are up, all right?
Tomorrow?
I can't. Well, I don't... Wednesday, but don't count on it, because I don't know for sure. I don't...
I miss you, Richard. I really miss you. I love you.
Okay. Hang up, okay?
I love you. I love you. I love you.
What feelings were you having as you saw this? What do you think the church can do for families of people who are in prison? Yes?
The thing that doesn't happen, that needs to happen, is it's almost like the family has leprosy because one member went, and a lot of families who have never had that experience don't realize it can happen to any family. You know, you're in control of yourself, but you're not in control of your brother.
Right.
And it can happen to anyone, and yet when if it does happen, whether it's, I think primarily it's a matter of, I'm afraid to embarrass them. They probably don't want to talk about it, is the sense. So you don't talk about But what happens to that family is then they feel completely ostracized. No one's reaching out to them at a time when they need it more than ever.
Just a second. It was a continual battle to ward off the depression and temptation to give up and hide, to sell out, move away, to just give up. The shame I felt that somehow I was responsible. The paranoia when I would write a check and sign my name. Did the grocery store clerk recognize that name? I felt betrayal of our wedding vows. How can one feel so many emotions in such a short time? Yes.
My son was in jail 12 different times in the last 3 years. And we've been in the position of these people. So I speak from experience. And what we felt as a family, well, all of the hell is just a small, I would rather go to hell almost than go through some 3 years like we did. It was, couldn't be worse in hell than to see your son beaten up by monsters. Anyway, how it affected our family was my other son completely withdrew into himself and still doesn't really know who we are left. My husband and I have had real strained relations. It just about broke us up. We were at each other's throats all the time. And it changed our perspective on each other. The son that was in jail, he's doing better. He's coming out of a little bit, his troubles, but the terror of the night is still there. When the phone rings at night, the only thing to think of, please, what have they got now? The police used to come to our house at night and raid our house, looking for my son and stuff and everything. But what we really suffered the most from was the rejection of our community. We live in a small town, Leavenworth, and my husband's a government official and I work in the hospital. And people just totally kicked us out of that society. They wouldn't talk to us. They didn't know one, not one person from that church came to see us, not even the pastor, in 3 years. My husband cannot go back to church. He has completely rejected church. He's thrown God out of his life because why need it? Why have it if that's what God is? They can point the finger and shame us and do everything to us. What good is a church? They do that. I can't blame them. For 3 years, we were not invited out. We were not called by people socially. We were not, no one came over. And it was all undercurrent. Everybody knew our name was in the paper all the time with this trouble. And really, I had thought the church would do better. I thought it was my family. We were so active. We were both on the church board and lay ministers. And they completely rejected us. And we couldn't go to church anymore. I had to start going to a different church where they accepted me because they do prison ministry in that church. So I'm just here to tell you and beg you, if you know anybody that has a member in jail, a family, someone that's grieving, it's like, you know, it's like having leprosy. Worse, because they can be treated, can be approached, but if you know anybody in my shoes, for God's sake, don't desert them. Yeah. Be kind, to talk about their missing person. Nobody in town would mention my son's name for 3 years. It was like they were saying Satan or something. I wanted people to ask how he was.
Sure.
I wanted, like, he was away. He was gone, but he was also alive, and he's still a member of the church. It took 2 years before our minister even went to visit him, for Pete's sake. You know, know, so if you ever know anyone in my shoes, don't let this happen to them. We really needed some support. We had nobody to turn to, only ostracism. It is still there, it hasn't changed, but people are a little forgiving or forgetful, I suppose, something like that. But when people look at me or talk to me, I know what they're thinking. You know, it's written on their face. It's the mother of a criminal. And that's what they see me as. So just remember that if you know anybody, go to them and talk. We need to talk. We need to talk. We need to be able to say, he's getting therapy, he's doing well, but he's learning, he's taking a long time, and thanks for asking. I mean, if you knew someone with a relative with cancer, you wouldn't desert them. It's the same kind of thing. It's a family problem, and so much pain.
Thank you for sharing. I'll never forget the day that I visited a young man. He was new to the system. He was in orientation, scared as all get out. He was 15 years old in an adult prison. And I asked him if it would be all right if I called his pastor. And he'd been there 2 weeks now already. And he said, oh, that would be great. I want my pastor to come to see me. It would be great to see a familiar face because all I see here are faces of strangers. I don't know who to trust. And so I went to my office and called this pastor, and I couldn't believe it. This pastor said, this young man has so embarrassed our congregation that none of us will want to see him, and my church council has advised me not to go see him either.
I believe it.
I couldn't believe it, that this actually happens. But I know that it's true, and it's sad that that happens. And so I want to thank you folks for being a part of tonight, to hearing the pathos that is in these letters written by wives of inmates. And like our guest said, if you know of someone, reach out to them. Start a weight program in your area. Please take sheets here if you don't have them, pick them up. Sign the list that was going around your address. But here again, folks, because of the shame, many of these people will remain hidden and we won't be able to see them. Thank you so much for coming.